You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.
Well, they could hardly wait to get their triggers loaded when the airplanes hitting the towers exploded. You should have seen them on the big TV. It was the first great war of the 21st century. The flames are still burning. They already had their man. They said he was hiding in the mountains of Afghanistan. We asked to see the evidence. They said they couldn't show. This is war, they said, and that's all you need to know. America, you're scaring me. You're making me ashamed. You're going out for blood, and I can't let you do it. Not in my American name. You want to talk about the body count? Well, let's run it up the mast. Almost 3,000 people died in that New York City blast. And there's about 5,000 people every month that you kill, strangling Iraq for a dirty dollar bill. And you want to talk about brutality? All right, let's get it out. Depleted uranium, now what's that all about? Innocent victims, can you even see their tears? Irradiated homelands for 4 billion years. And you want to talk about the terrorists and what makes them run? Well, you taught them everything they know. You even gave them their guns. Every killer with a grudge is just a tool to be used. And then you forget about them until they make the news. America, you're scaring me, you're making me ashamed. You're going out for blood and I can't let you do it. Not in my American name. Eye for an eye is the justice that you claim. Yeah, but the numbers that we're talking about are a whole different game. Millions of people have no safe place to hide. That's not justice, my friend, that's genocide. So I'm gonna have my say, and I'll say it loud and clear. In every crowd, in every corner, every place I can find an ear. And you can try to shut me up, but no matter what you do, I got a right to speak, cause I'm American too. America, you're scaring me, you're making me ashamed. You're going out for blood, and I can't let you do it. Not in my American name. America, you're scaring me, you're making me ashamed. You're going out for blood and I just can't let you do it. Not in my American name.
That was Jim Page performing Not in My American Name. Joel Covell is a professor of social studies at Bard College in New York, a former Green Party candidate for the Senate and presidency, a former psychotherapist, and a longtime public intellectual. He spoke with Sue Supriano last month about his recent book, The Enemy of Nature, The End of Capitalism, or The End of the World.
I wrote this book in order to get people moving, that they could begin to feel that there is an alternative and that there has to be an alternative. I chose the very first sentence carefully, and it goes something like, increasing numbers of people are coming to the conclusion that capitalism is the uncontrolling uncontrollable force driving our ecological crisis. And then I go on to say, only to become frozen in their tracks by the awesome implications of the inside. Because while it's necessary and a good thing to undertake various kinds of reforms and to help with recycling or to help with clean elections and do all these things, I think a lot of people do realize that there is something larger. There's a world system at work, and that world system, through its ever-present expansion, which has a truly cancerous quality, is basically destabilizing ecosystems on a planetary scale. And because it keeps expanding and because it shows no signs of being controllable, because it has a chaotic world system that it runs, it distinctly places the whole future at risk. And to put it, use a fashionable term, it's unsustainable. And I mean, people have talked about that and so forth, but what I try to do is specify what's unsustainable is the capitalist system as such. Now, I don't mean to say that the capitalist system is just an economic arrangement. It has many, many deeper implications. It's built on a foundation of centuries or really millennia of domination, and particularly by gender, and it has many aspects, but it is now controlling the world and bringing the entire planet under its regime, trying to convert everything to commodities, relentlessly expanding, because for any capitalist firm or capitalist class or capitalist nation, to not grow is to die. It's basically a system that has no hope of equilibrium. Mm-hmm. And so as it continues to grow, and I give all kinds of evidence and detail within the book, but as it continues to grow, it obviously breaks down the human relationship to nature at many, many points. And since we are part of nature and live from nature, mm-hmm. it places the future of civilization at grave risk. And I want people to face up to that. I want people to try to think about what causes this and how it can be confronted. And I believe that that the hopelessness, the sort of learned helplessness that we have, the inability to think that there can be an alternative, is part of the system. So the first step in breaking loose from the system is to recognize that it's trying to make us feel this way, that it after all is only a human arrangement, however powerful, that it is in a moment of grave crisis, that it is losing legitimacy all around the world. People are in fact rising up all around the world, and I want the readers of this book to recognize that we are all in a moment of great historical crisis, but a crisis is an opportunity as well as a danger, as the great Chinese ideogram put it. So I want people to see this as an opportunity and not to retreat from it, but to move ahead and to try to figure out ways of building a world beyond capital and to start on that task now.
Mm-hmm. Well, you shared with me that you used to be a psychiatrist. Denial and hopelessness and helplessness are really very key here. And people also say, but we don't know what to do. And I think, well, why don't you know what to do?
I don't want to blame people. I don't think it's stupid for individual people to be that way, mm-hmm. because we all are fed a diet that encourages us to believe that. I mean, the notion that there is no alternative is articulated by Margaret Thatcher back in the 70s, and it's been widely trumpeted by ideologues and intellectuals and scholars and think tanks and, of course, politicians and public relations industries. We have a colossal enterprise in this society of sort of getting people to think things the way the ruling elites want us to think. And therefore, the average person, A, is denied key information, is told false things, that namely that the system is in fact taking care of business, and it is in fact a reasonable world, whereas it's not a reasonable world. And people know that, but they don't have a way of getting in touch with their knowledge, because the surface is controlled by all these institutions of the press, the media, the intellectuals, the thing, whatever. It's a big system. So I don't think it's that people are stupid, but their better ideas are kept sequestered, both within themselves and between themselves. I believe that as people become detached from this system, as they begin to recognize that there are, in fact, you know, grave problems, that the world is not being well managed at all, that the future is, in fact, at risk, that their children and grandchildren's lives are very much at stake here, I do have faith in human beings. I do think that we are capable as a species of very creative responses. I think those responses are just buried beneath this pile of hopelessness. And that's what the denial is, because it seems overwhelming. It may be overwhelming in the long run, but it's not overwhelming for any individual person to begin taking stock of this and to begin linking up with others. Because, you know, wherever we're going to go in the long run, there has to be a first step and another step. And all those steps can be taken. And we'll take those steps as far as we can take them. Just turn on the TV set. Look at the ads. Look at the way it's celebrated. Look at the way the lifestyle is celebrated in the glossy magazines. You look at the way, you know, the president talks and the way he is put together this so-called war on terrorism to try to scare people out of thinking for themselves and to just fall in line behind a policy that is objectively insane. As you know, just recently, the president admitted, not that he himself would do that, but he was told to admit, that, yes, global warming is taking place, yet, yes, human society is responsible by producing greenhouse gases, yes, this is a serious problem, but on the other hand, don't expect him or the administration to do anything about it, it's tough, you just have to learn to adapt. Now, that's the kind of outrageous statement that shows you that this system is, in fact, utterly bankrupt, that it cannot take care of life. And people have to suddenly come to and say, hey, this cannot be tolerated. The long-term effects of global warming, which I would emphasize is only one part of the ecological crisis, although, of course, immense, are horrendous to contemplate when they're talking about global temperature rising by as much as 9 degrees by the end of the century. We're talking about countries like Bangladesh being underwater by the year 2050. And where are those 200 million people going to go? And what about all the other cities that are going to be underwater, like New Orleans and Venice, Italy, and many, many other places? And we realize the terrible crises induced by migrations and the destabilizations that are taking place even now, and recognize that this is only going to grow exponentially. And then you see that this system, this government, this capitalist order is absolutely incapable of rationally dealing with the future and the fate of people. So this should be a sign for people to say, enough, enough, we must think of alternatives.
It seems to me that basically the people in power understand very well that the resources are running out, which is the case. There's no question about that. There may be a question about which year the oil's going to be gone.
Absolutely. But there's another side to it, which is equally important. The most important consideration for capitalism is profits. Profits must keep increasing. And ideally, the rate of profit must keep increasing. It's not just that they should make a reasonable profit, but that profit has to keep increasing. When the system goes into crisis, starts getting into a downturn, that is an alarm bell. And the whole Bush administration is centered and focused, and its raison d'etre is to try to restore this lagging capitalist system by all means necessary, including war, and including rolling back even the slender environmental safeguards that were put into place over the last 30 years. Because these environmental safeguards are all brakes and checks on accumulation or profitability. And people have to face up to that. The Bush administration, of course, is a right-wing Republican administration, was put into power without legitimacy. It didn't really win the election. But that just shows how important this crisis is taken by the ruling elites. So, yes, the longer or middle-range picture is running out of resources. Yes, it is necessary to secure the remaining oil and get natural gas. It's in the Caspian Sea, although it should be pointed out that the reason that the Bush administration wants to control those resources is not directly for the use of the United States, but to actually control them, to control other societies that do need them, like China, India, and Japan, who are major, you know, prizes in the world economic picture. So this is all played out in terms of complex interrelationship between economics, geostrategics, and the, you know, their perception of what the Earth's ecologies will tolerate. But the common root of that is that this is a capitalist system that must grow without end. And these guys have internalized it. They don't have any choice. They can't think anything else. I think it's important for listeners to realize that the capitalist is not free. He himself is a slave to this system. He just exists to expand the capital under his supervision. And if he stops doing it, he's kicked out. I mean, he has a, you know, golden parachute and all that. He does very well. But he loses his prestige. He loses his power. And so these guys fight. Or to put it another way, the guys who are selected for this long process of socialization to get to the top of the system are ruthless, cold, calculating fighters who have no soft edges to them and are incapable of seeing just what an ecological disaster they're actually planning for the world. Or they just see it in a very, very dim way. That's the real denial.
So what to do starting now?
That gap between rich and poor, that immiseration of masses of people, shows that capital produces not just wealth but poverty. And with the widening gap between rich and poor, it creates a chaotic world that makes for terrorism and all these wars, and also makes it impossible to rationally deal with the crisis. So the very first thing to do is to is to recognize and wake up and sort of lift up your eyes, you know, and stop sort of just looking at the most immediate creature comforts, but to start looking at the largest circumstance and to start building towards the future, and to educate yourself, you know, to start, you know, studying and learning and working with others. But the general principle of what has to be done is this. I'd like to put it on a somewhat abstract level because it's rather more hopeful if you can do that. Basically, what capitalism does is that it inserts commodities everywhere in the world, and commodities are like clothes moths that sort of eat up the fabric of ecosystems. I mean, the capitalist kind of commodity, it snips those things that bind together or connect things and produces separated, isolated people as well.
Well, that is pretty abstract.
I'm going to get right into
it. I mean, I understand. Okay.
But what I want people to realize is that capitalism destabilizes ecosystems, whether it's a community, you know, whether it's a forest. It breaks up the rich interconnection of things. So the basic movement against this has to be to recreate healthy, flourishing ecosystems. That's the essentials of this ecological politics. The ultimate goal of this is to reach a society wherein people are free to creatively produce and where they're not separated from the means of their production, so that they can in fact build the kind of world that they need, and not having experts do it, but it's a full democratization of the world. And in doing so, they also change their needs. They're not subject to the kind of materialist impulses that is really an alienation of our power as human beings. So the ultimate goal is a society which I call eco-socialism, because it's grounded in the earliest socialisms, but it's very, very different from them in many respects. But I want to put that word out there so that people can think about it. But it's a society where people are freely associated from below, maximally democratic, and in which they now learn to recognize themselves in nature and nature in themselves. Now, the path to that is multiform. There is no single royal road. It's not like, you know, you get the industrial workers, although the industrial workers are important. It includes mothers. It includes teachers. It includes really every point of human existence, gardeners. It includes those who would build, you know, community centers. It includes what people are doing already, people, you know, who are beginning to awaken. But it adds to that, that they have to begin to look beyond what they're doing already and to look beyond both towards this ultimate goal, which I just mentioned, which is kind of a free society in harmony with nature, and to start looking to form linkages with other people. And to start organizing themselves and to start interconnecting themselves. And there's a lot at hand about that. I mean, you know, the green parties are play a role, but it's also very much of an international movement. We had a World Social Forum at Porto Alegre in Brazil. It's going to be repeated next year and then the year after in India. People have to get involved in that because this is also entails a new kind of planetary consciousness. We have to recognize that we're one species on one planet that's floating through space, and our destiny is to care for that planet as a whole. But as we do that, we have to reach out to other people. So it's a combination of building locally, and a healthy ecosystem is as elementary as a mother and a child. A mother is a healthy ecosystem. Why? Because an ecosystem is like elements, has elements that are separate but connected, and they undergo development. And that's what raising a child is, or that's what growing a garden is, or that's what, you know, playing a string quartet is, or so, you know, and that's what building a political party is, and that's what, you know, building, you know, a community center, building new forms of production. But these forms of production have to be seen as beyond capital, and that's the hard part, because capital exists by exploiting labor. That's what capital is about. It's not a rational system of markets. It's a way in which some people exploit and extract the labor of others and control that. So that has to be undone, because that's a non-healthy ecosystem. So I know I'm, you know, sort of hastening over a huge terrain here, but I want the listeners to realize that there is, in fact, a whole world out there that is open for this. But we have to look at the long range and the whole picture and begin reaching out to others and begin building, you know, new forms of political association and new forms of production. And there are many things that are happening like this, like independent media collectives. There's a movement called the Indie Media Movement that represents autonomous production from below, spontaneous, non-hierarchical, non-exploitative of labor. You see, it begins to meet the criterion of what is a good, healthy, growing ecosystem. So I want people to feel that they have ample means of participation from where they live, but they have to begin looking beyond where they live to a planetary level and to the long picture. And that will, I think, deepen their resistance and gradually prepare them for the struggle that's bound to emerge. And I try to outline that in the last third of my book.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I wish we had more time. It's going so quick. Well, Joel Covell, I'm thinking, because I agree with you, and I don't know if everybody's understanding what you're talking about, ecosystems and of course, in capitalism and socialism, those words that kind of light people up sometimes. But in any case, and I am involved personally in some of those things, and we come back because we still live in a capitalist society, and I've always said, well, capitalism is based on exploitation. That's the bottom line. There's no way of getting around that. Just isn't. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, just realistically, to have a community center, for instance, mm-hmm. or everybody needs money. That's capital. I mean, in a way. I mean, we're talking about capitalism. But right now, you need money to get the wood, to get the cement, to hire the carpenters. I mean, everybody can't be working for free, or maybe they can. But I'm involved with the indie media. It's wonderful because there's no money and people don't get. But you got to have the computers. You can maybe get some computers donated. But those people got to have food and where they got to have a job that brings money for, you know, somewhere this money comes into the picture.
Well, nobody said it was going to be easy. It's a struggle, and money is real. Money is the sign that we are stuck in this society, and there's no way you can abolish this society. I wouldn't even want to. I mean, if we could say, just erase everything that it is and start all over. That's crazy. You have to build from within. You have to build from within and connect from within. And it is absolutely a struggle. But I do believe, because I mean, there are many instances in my own life, I think in your own and the reader's lives, if you think about it, there are many instances where you can see that cooperative endeavor, that new forms of work and labor can be joyous, they can be life-affirming, they can be non-materialistic, and they can not eliminate the need for money, because that would be, a fantasy, but it can change the terms. It can make people relatively freer, and as they become relatively freer, they become relatively more hopeful, they become relatively able to join up with others, they deepen their studies. And remember, this is all predicated on an unfolding crisis. I would say that were the situation to simply extrapolate in the present terms, very little could happen. But I do believe that the structures are such that this is going to get a lot more hotted up as time goes on, and more interesting, perhaps, more hopeful, more dangerous. There are really two kinds of curves that are going on in the world today. There's a curve of this form of progressive destruction with authoritarian governments. I mean, new kinds of fascist governments that are rising, terrible deprivations of freedom, clamping down everything for growth. And then there's another curve of life-affirming protest and rebuilding on a world scale, this kind of planetary consciousness. Remember, at Puerto Alegre, last January, the people said, another world is possible. Now, that hadn't been said before this year. I mean, occasionally, but as a part of a movement. And that means that the ideas such as that I'm talking about are surfacing in people's minds all around the world. When they can start thinking another world is possible, then they are beyond the deadly notion of there is no alternative. And that gives hope, and hope gives strength, and well, who knows? But it's those two curves. The question is which one will get to the future and which one will determine our fate.
Right. And all this is process and new considerations in how we do things, like having less stuff, spending less money, growing food, using alternative energy methods with things. I mean, it's a whole bunch of things. It's not, as you said in the beginning, it's not just one thing.
Yeah. It's a whole way of being. It's not just economic arrangements, is not passing this law, that law. It's an entire radical transformation of our human being in relation to nature. And that's what makes it very exciting. I think as people recognize that, they can say, well, these are terrible times, but we're living in a tremendous challenge and openness and opportunity. And let's move ahead.
That was Joel Covell speaking with Sue Supriano. We'll conclude the program with a return to the issue of patriotism and the recent Pledge of Allegiance controversy with historian Cecilia O'Leary, author of the recent book, To Die For, The Paradox of American Patriotism. She spoke earlier this month with V-Man of Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Dr. Cecilia O'Leary begins in this interview with her reaction to the June 26th Federal Appeals Court ruling that the phrase under God in the Pledge of Allegiance is an unconstitutional endorsement of religion.
I think it's an important decision. I think that particularly in the wake of September 11th, that it's time for us to debate and question and rethink not only the wording of the Pledge of Allegiance, but even if we want to have our school children pledging a daily loyalty oath.
I think it's particularly poignant that they actually included that in their ruling about the impressionability of school children. I'm wondering if you could expand on that a little more for our listeners.
Well, a little history might be helpful. The first pledge, in fact, that was very popular before the one that we currently use, that was recited in public schools in the 1890s, in fact, had the word God in it, and it was, we give our head and our hearts to God and country, one nation, one language, one flag. And that was written at a time when there was, a massive immigration of Southern and Eastern Europeans, and across the East Coast in particular, where the public schools were beginning to get organized at the end of the 19th century, there was a great concern among particularly Anglo-Saxon middle-class reformers that these new immigrants were somehow going to weaken the Anglo-Saxon traditions of the United States, that because they were overwhelmingly working class, that their children were going to create chaos by joining unions, by striking, by becoming anarchist workers. And so the intent of the pledge movement in the very beginning was really to enforce social control. And it was a part of a whole movement that saw the schools as really machines for political socialization. So when the immigrant children were taught to say, we give our heads and our hearts to God and our country, one nation, one language, one flag, it was really about discipline and the emphasis on creating a disciplined workforce. And when Francis Bellamy in 1892 wrote the pledge that we now use, he was a Christian socialist. He was both a minister and a socialist. When he wrote the words of the pledge that we now recite, he reflected in his diaries, and these are his words, that he thought that this pledge that was popular about giving the heads and hearts to God and country was a pretty childish form of words. And he did not purposely put in the word God into his pledge. And instead, what he tried to do with the pledge is think about, well, okay, what can I write that maybe has a little bit more resonance with our history, that could create a social citizenry where the emphasis isn't on just rote memorization and socialization, but brings up some of the ideas behind what this country is about. And he even entertained the idea of putting in the slogan from the French Revolution, which was equality, liberty, and fraternity. And the notion of equality was extraordinarily radical. I mean, it continues to be an extraordinarily radical concept even today. But particularly at the end of the 19th century, as we enter into the 20th century, there was a tremendous pitched battles between working class and the capitalist class. There was a major railway strike that happened in the 1870s where the newspapers even had headlines that said communism in the West, solely because railway workers were striking for better working conditions. So Bellamy thought twice. He said, well, I don't think folks are ready for the French revolutionary slogan, so what I'm going to put in the pledge is liberty and justice for all. And even that was quite a stretch, to say liberty and justice for all. And what he said in his diaries, which I found up in Upper State, New York, in the University of Rochester archives, is he said, I'm going to leave it for later generations to decide whether we're a capitalist or a socialist country. So the intent of his pledge, in fact, was to get children to think about what's the future of this country. But in fact, what happened to his pledge was that it was turned into a ritual that just degenerated into memorization, where now when children say the pledge, I know different friends of mine who teach grammar school, they say the kids think that they're pledging their allegiance to Richard Stans and want to know who this man is, Richard Stans. So what turned out to be, what started out as a pledge that was not supposed to enforce social coercion among children, in fact, has become its opposite, which is to create tremendous pressure for children just to pledge an uncritical kind of lockstep allegiance that doesn't question what our flag represents, but instead has them pledging allegiance to my country, right or wrong.
Mm-hmm. Webster's dictionary defines the term patriot as, one quote, one who loves his country and zealously supports its authorities and interests. Listed as a synonym along with this definition is the word nationalist, and I'm curious what thoughts you have on this particular definition of the term patriot.
Well, do you know what year of Webster's dictionary that is?
I think that's 97 from my memory.
97. Could you just repeat that in terms of a zealous?
Sure. It says, quote, one who loves his country and zealously supports its authority and interests, end quote.
Well, that's very interesting that they use the term zealously protects the interests of their country. I mean, I think that by and large, patriotism is defined by someone who sees their own self-interest tied up with the interests of the nation state. And I think that zealously protects and is in fact what has become of patriotism more often than not, particularly in times of war, where instead of being a patriot, meaning to be someone who democratically participates in the nation and the nation's relationships with peoples not only in the United States but internationally, instead it's been something that's degenerated into, too often than not, a mindless my country right or wrong, which has been very anti-democratic. So in fact, even though I don't agree with that definition, that a patriot is also a zealot, I think a patriot should be someone who furthers critical inquiry and democratic participation. In fact, I think it's quite accurate in terms of what historically has happened in the United States. And I think if we look at, for example, the Spanish-American War, when the U.S. was fighting its first imperialist war halfway across the world, during that war, basically the whole notion of a patriot was to be an imperialist, and there was an incredible anti-imperialist movement that developed in opposition to that definition. In fact, that movement said, "How can you be a republic and a democracy and try and also be imposing an imperialism on people around the world?" So there was a struggle over the meaning of patriot then. Then during World War One, you had a passage of the Alien and Sedition Acts, where basically any opposition to the war was absolutely silenced. You had Eugene Debs, who simply in a speech questioned the war and said that he thought it was the interest in the interest of capitalists, and he was imprisoned. You had what I'd call ethnic profiling, similar to racial profiling, where German Americans, and this took place in Santa Cruz, in the city that you're broadcasting from, anyone who is suspected of being German-American, many German-Americans changed their names trying to disguise that they weren't German-Americans because they didn't want to become the targets of angry mobs. Anyone suspected of not having enough patriotism or possibly of being German-American, crowds of people would form around them and demand that they kiss the flag. And when people refused to kiss the flag, they would be, you know, taken into their county jail. And in one example, in the Midwest, a man, because he refused to kiss the flag, was sentenced to 20 years of hard labor in the state penitentiary. And when the appeals judge heard his case, he said, "You've been more sinned against than you've sinned." He said, "I wish I could reverse this decision, but I can't in terms of the legislation that's been passed, the wartime legislation." And in fact, he said, "I think that what this represents is that we've descended back into the Salem witch trials again." And so you had an incredible amount of coercion and irrational zealot patriotism coming to the fore during World War One. And then during World War Two, which no one can disagree that wasn't a just war. I mean, it was a war against fascism. Very little opposition to it. But during that war, you had the racialization of patriotism. You had Japanese Americans, again, right in the town surrounding the city that you're broadcasting from, who were rounded up. They were put into the Salinas Rodeo grounds and held there before they were then sent out to internment camps around the country. And there wasn't a single act of treason that was found against a Japanese American. And in fact, while Japanese Americans, mothers, fathers, sons, daughters, cousins, nephews, nieces were being placed in internment camps, you had one of the most celebrated units of World War II being made up of Japanese Americans. And so there you have the contradiction, where patriotism is supposed to hold out democracy, but too often it degenerates into the cause of zealotry. And that, in fact, is why I entitled my book, To Die For, The Paradox of American Patriotism, a paradox. Because American patriotism holds out the ideals that are in the Declaration of Independence, but it's practiced, we often find, particularly during times of war, that in the words of Barbara Lee, we become what we're fighting against. And then during the Korean War, Cold War, we have the whole attack on supposed communists inside the United States, the Red Scare, when people who simply signed a petition, you know, in favor of fair housing or, you know, jobs for the unemployed, found that their careers, their lives were destroyed. And then most recently during the Vietnam War, because an entire generation that I was a part of felt that the U.S. had betrayed the principles that we'd been brought up to believe it stood for, you know, formed an anti-war movement. And the FBI, totally illegally, sent in agent provocateurs to disrupt peaceful demonstrations, to infiltrate classrooms where professors were teaching, to take notes on their lectures, turned us basically into spies where we spied against each other and, you know, questioned each other's integrity. That became the basis of what it meant to be a patriot, rather than a patriot is someone that upholds its country to its ideals and says, no, you know, this war in Vietnam is unjust. Well, I think that being a patriot shouldn't be defined by just zealotry. I think being a patriot is someone who upholds ideals and critically questions the direction this country is going in.
Oftentimes, one way people express their dissent is by burning the flag. And as you note in your book, a lot of the symbols of patriotism, you know, and these rituals that we go through are somewhat new in our history. I mean, this country, we're about to celebrate 226 years of independence, you know, tomorrow, and I'm just struck by how recent many of these, you know, rituals are. As you pointed out earlier, the pledge wasn't written until 1891, 1892, and also the Flag Desecration Act wasn't even implemented until 1968. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this.
Well, what I think it tells us is that oftentimes, particularly the religious right and conservative Republicans and Democrats, you know, hold up the 4th of July, the Star-Spangled Banner, Memorial Day, the Pledge of Allegiance, as if they're sort of timeless, consensual representations of American culture. But in fact, they're relatively very recent inventions, and they most of them got invented or institutionalized after the Civil War, at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, and even into our time, as you're saying, in terms of the Flag Desecration Act. So what this means is that instead of these being symbols that are timeless, that represent the majority will, instead they're symbols and rituals that, in fact, if we look at history, we'll find that they've been deeply contested, that there's been struggles over what their meaning should be. And I think to this day, there's struggles over what the meaning of the flag is. And too often we take with our mass media and mainstream media, you know, and pronunciations that come out of the White House, that the meaning of the flag and patriotism was all sewn up to just represent, for example, what President Bush has to say about the recent Ninth Court decision that found the pledge unconstitutional, where he says, you know, this goes against 200 years of our history. It doesn't go against 200 years of our history. It was only in 1954 that Eisenhower allowed the words "under God" to be added to the pledge. And even then, it was in the height of the Cold War. It was to assert ourselves, the United States, against a godless communism, you know, that we're the God-fearing nation. But in fact, it was the Knights of Columbus, which is a conservative Catholic organization. I know it well because my grandfather was in it. I remember seeing his Knights of Columbus sword and his sash on the bed before he'd get ready to go to meetings. It was the Knights of Columbus who agitated that "Under God be placed" in the pledge. So I find it, so it's not as if this is going against 200 years of history. In fact, it's going against a decision that was made in 54 that was highly questionable at the time. It was politically and ideologically inserted into the pledge against both a godless communism in the Soviet Union, as well as part of the Cold War and the Red Scare here in the United States against anyone who might not, you know, conform to what a godly person was considered. And that really has nothing to do with citizenship. I mean, people, belief in God or not a belief in God is really a private opinion that should take place in churches. The Pledge of Allegiance isn't a prayer.
In a June 28th opinion piece entitled "Trivializing a Big Issue, Exactly Who's Victimized by the Existence of the Words Under God in the Pledge of Allegiance," the editors of the daily Santa Cruz Sentinel ask the following, quote, "In a world in which innocent people are murdered, in which people lose their life's savings because of lying and cheating by financial leaders, in which schools are failing, who really wants to worry about two words in the Pledge of Allegiance?" The editors go on to state, in part, "We can't imagine that any single person has been prevented from pursuing his or her freedom of expression in any way because of those two words in the Pledge of Allegiance. What next? Recalling all coins and dollar bills because of the 'In God We Trust' line?" Cecilia O'Leary, what is your reaction to this opinion piece?
Well, I both agree and disagree with it. I agree with it in the point it's making that all of, you know, the pronouncements coming out of the Congress and from President Bush is hyperbole. I mean, everybody has come out, you know, wrapped themselves in the flag, pledging allegiance on the steps, you know, outside of Congress, you know, taking up all of the space in the newspapers, when in fact what just happened was that the Supreme Court just ruled that vouchers were okay in Cincinnati. Which basically means that taxpayers' money is going to go to support religious schools, which is a very serious decision in terms of violation of separation of church and state. So at that level, I think they're absolutely right. I think the Republicans really wanted to use this decision as a way to wrap themselves in the flag. I mean, Bush came out and even said, you know, this shows why my court-appointed judges need to go through and the Democrats have to hold up their appointments. I mean, that's just political hay. I mean, in fact, the judge who wrote the opinion was a Nixon appointee. He's a moderate Republican. It has nothing to do with what judges Bush is trying to appoint. I mean, this judge is a Republican judge. So they're being very ideological in terms of how they're trying to use this. And, of course, the Democrats just jumped right on the bandwagon immediately and said, oh, no, you're not going to outdo us. We're going to show that, you know, we support the Pledge of Allegiance as well. So I think it's fairly hypocritical and opportunistic in terms of how it's being used. And there's deeper issues that we need to be talking about in terms of separation of church and state. So I agree with them in that point. But I disagree that it's not important. I think it is important because I think that having children make a loyalty oath, the Constitution, nowhere in the Constitution does it mandate a loyalty oath being made every single day. I think that we have to really think about, is that the form and the direction that we want patriotic education to go in our schools? Because after September 11th, after several decades of the pledge really ceasing to be used in the public schools and teachers coming up with much more inventive classroom discussions and exercises and ways of teaching children how to become Democrats and participants in this country, all of a sudden there was a great cry that went up among local school boards and state legislatures to reinstitute a daily pledging of allegiance. So I think it does matter. And I think it's not a minor thing that even for 30 seconds a day, I mean, in terms of children saying a pledge, that we're turning patriotic, what it means to be a patriot, into a daily catechism recital in the schools. I think we need to think about that. I don't think that makes sense in terms of trying to educate children who will be our next leaders in a world where we now are fighting a war supposedly with no borders and no end. I mean, I don't think we want to just create mindless kids who march in lockstep and don't question the country critically. So I both agree and disagree with that editorial.
Again, we're speaking with Cecilia O'Leary. She is a professor of American history at the California State University at Monterey Bay, and she's also the author of the book To Die For, The Paradox of American Patriotism. The pledge now, is this mandatory for students to recite every day? What about students who are foreign exchange students who may have allegiance to another country? Are they mandated, or is it mandatory that they recite the pledge every day?
Well, as of now, in 1943, the Supreme Court decided that you cannot force children to have to say the Pledge of Allegiance. This came after thousands of Jehovah's Witnesses had been persecuted, their children expelled from the schools because they don't feel that they should be having to pledge allegiance to a power and place above God, which is the nation. So you had incredible oppression of Jehovah's Witnesses that took place. And so the Supreme Court finally decided in 43, no, you can't force children to say the Pledge of Allegiance. But what we have now is you have school boards basically encouraging their schools to say the Pledge of Allegiance every morning, but if a child wants to dissent and sit down and not say the Pledge of Allegiance, they can't then expel that child from school. But you have to realize, and I think we all do, that it would take an extraordinarily courageous child to basically stand up to his 20, 30, 40, 50 classmates who are being led by their teacher and pledging allegiance and to say, no, I'm sitting this one out. I'm not going to do that. And in fact, there's a very moving example from World War I where an African-American child, Herbert Eves, that I found in my research, he basically said, I'm not going to salute the flag till the flag can salute me. Mm-hmm. And what he was protesting, which is quite courageous for his day and age, and was that African Americans during the end of the 19th, early 20th century were being lynched constantly in the South. And the federal government had not outlawed lynching, had taken no steps to stop this. And so what he was saying was that if my flag stands for a country that allows lynching of African Americans, then I'm not going to pledge my loyalty to it, which I think that was an act of a patriot. And for doing that, he was expelled from school, and the school took him before a court to be tried for being a disloyal citizen, for being a traitor. And the judge said, I cannot try this child. I have no grounds for putting this child in jail at this point for refusing to pledge allegiance. So the school was forced to take the child back. But can you? I mean, that's just quite extraordinary. And there's not, that's an unusual child that's going to be willing to stand up, or that's going to also be able to step outside of the pressure of school and form their own opinion and be able to have the wherewithal to go up against not only a school but also a judge in terms of critiquing what they think the United States is doing. In fact, the Pledge of Allegiance, and initially the way it was written, not only didn't include God, but it didn't include the flag of the United States of America. That was added after World War I when 100% Americanizers, those were people, the American Legion was very prominent among the 100% Americanizers, who really saw what it meant to be an American as being white and Anglo-Saxon and Protestant. And so they added the flag of the United States because they wanted to make sure there were no children, fifth columnists, who were secretly pledging allegiance to another country. So you have the history of this flag being one that was that's been grossly distorted from its original intent when it was written to create a social citizenry, and instead it's become a pledge that's trying to seek out, you know, conniving fifth columnist children, or, you know, asserting ourselves against a godless communism. When the Cold War is over, we're not fighting the Cold War any longer. And so you really have a situation where, though it's not something that children have to say, just to be realistic, children are not going to be able to stand outside and protest this in any kind of way. You know, that you could expect from a first grader, a second grader, a third grader, fourth, fifth, seventh, eighth.
Right. I do have two more quick questions. I know you have to be going, but I wanted to get these two in. Mm-hmm. First, how is the U.S. flag exploited by advertisers?
Oh, that's such an important issue, because the patriotism, the struggle over whether patriotism represents the ideals in the Declaration of Independence that we need to struggle each generation to realize, or whether it's something that just sells, has been a struggle that's been with us for since practically the beginning of the founding of this country. Certainly at the end of the 19th century, when modern advertising begins to take off, the flag and its commercial purposes goes back. Oh, even after the Civil War, there were struggles over the use of the flag. Veterans after the Civil War were very concerned that the flag both represent the fact that they'd lost almost an entire generation, either to death during the Civil War or certainly to being either psychologically or physically maimed by it. So they wanted patriotism to represent some a higher dignity. But immediately after the Civil War, you saw furniture advertisers. I found one advertisement that had, it was an enormous full-page ad, and it was for furniture, and it said, you know, men fought and died in the Civil War, and what does it mean to fought and die in the Civil War on the side of the United States? Doesn't it really mean fighting? And I'm paraphrasing now, for home and family. And then it said, and what is home and family but your house? And then it said, but what is your house but furniture? And furniture in your house. Remember, when you go to buy your bedroom set, to choose well, because in the end, men fought and died in the Civil War for the furniture that you now have in your bedroom, which, I mean, is so hypocritical. And after September 11th, I saw an Ethan Allen ad for furniture with a bed wrapped in a flag, which again said, you know, buy American. And I thought, oh my God, you know, it's the commercial ownership of patriotism, where after September 11th, when Bush finally opened the airports, you know, instead of him saying, we have to really, you know, strive to continue to, you know, have this kind of outpouring of patriotism that we've seen in these last week, you know, people giving blood, people giving money to support the victims, people willing to go into their communities and think about what public service might mean. No, that's not what he said. He said, buy your tickets on the airlines and fly to Florida to visit Disneyland. And I thought, God, we've been reduced to the United Corporations of America. Yeah.
And finally, as we embark on this Independence Day weekend with the vague threats of possible terrorist attacks on tourist attractions all across the United States, the threat of never-ending war, and the knowledge that over 2 million people in this country currently reside behind bars, my biggest question for you is, do we have anything to celebrate this 4th of July?
I think that the 4th of July is a really important time to think about, to read the Declaration of Independence, to think about the fact that this country was founded in the contradiction of being a country that promised freedom, but at the same time enslaved Africans. And that to go back to something that Frederick Douglass said, who was an ex-slave who had fled to freedom, and in 1852, when he was speaking in front of a white audience on the 4th of July, he said, "This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice, I must mourn." I think that this is a time to think about, what is this 4th of July? Who is it for? Are the ideals in the Declaration being upheld? Are they being upheld not only nationally but globally? And how are we going to make a celebration of the 4th of July not just mean buying, you know, canvas chairs and beer bottles wrapped in the flag, but instead have it be a time when we rethink, okay, if we believe in these ideals, how are we making sure that this nation is living up to them?
Thanks to V-Man of Free Radio Santa Cruz for that interview.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
Which will come down like an